Hello and welcome to this interview on Season 2 of the Anxiety Summit. This is your host, Trudy Scott here. I'm a certified nutritionist. I'm known as a food mood expert and I'm the author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. If you tuned into Season 1, you'll remember today's wonderful speaker from that summit, Dr. Kelly Brogan. She spoke on Misunderstood and Mistreated Reinventing Psychiatry. We touched on inflammation and the gut. And today's topic is going to take a deeper dive into this fascinating topic. The title is Psychoneuroimmunology, the New Psychiatry. Kelly, welcome. It's a real pleasure having you back.
Thank you for keeping this going. It's very exciting. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm just really pleased to have you here. So let me read your bio and then we'll get started right away because this is really very fascinating and I know you've got some great info to share. Dr. Brogan is boarded in psychiatry, psychosomatic medicine, reproductive psychiatry, and integrative holistic medicine, and practices functional medicine, a root cause approach to illness as a manifestation of multiple interrelated systems. After studying cognitive neuroscience at MIT and receiving her MD from Cornell University, she completed her residency and fellowship at Bellevue, NYU. She is one of the nation's only physicians with perinatal psychiatric training who takes a holistic, evidence-based approach into the care of patients with a focus on environmental medicine and nutrition. She is also a mom of two and an active supporter of women's birth experience rights to birth empowerment and limiting of unnecessary interventions. She is a medical director for Fearless Parent and an advisory board member for Green Med Info, Pathways to Family Wellness, NYS Perinatal Association, and Fisher Wallace. She practices in New York City and is on the faculty at NYU Bellevue. So let's get started with our topic, psychoneuroimmunology, the new psychiatry. And I would love you to just share what psychoneuroimmunology is.
Absolutely. So it's probably one of my favorite words. And,
me too.
And there's a whole discipline devoted to it, but you wouldn't know that, from the lay press headlines. It's sort of tucked in the archives of PubMed online, but it's really a robust and burgeoning field. And I think why it's so appealing is because, you know, the limitations of conventional psychiatry, as we discussed last season, are apparent in moderate, you know, to minimal response rates, in short and long-term side effects. And, you know, I think the whole field is ready for a rebirth. And this is from the conventional side of the aisle and certainly from the holistic side of the aisle. We've been pioneering this for some time now. But what psychoneuroimmunology refers to is essentially the interconnectedness, the inherent interconnectedness between multiple systems. So it's about no longer looking at psychiatry as a head-up phenomenon, which at best can result in limited outcomes and at worst can be quite dangerous. And what psychoneuroimmunology implies is that there is a relationship between neurology, so between brain science, and the immune system, but it also sort of, and actually sometimes it's called psychoneuroendocrinology, it also sort of ropes in the gut and the endocrine system, you know, with the implication being that you cannot treat one without knowledge about the others. So I think it's very exciting and really is a term that embodies functional medicine or naturopathy, you know, at its best.
Wonderful. And as you say, it brings in all components. So we're getting to
yes.
The root cause of the problem. I love it. Now let's talk about the role of inflammation and how this ties into psychoneuroimmunology and then anxiety and depression.
Okay, so you know what psychiatry has been operating under for about the past 50 or so years is termed the monoamine hypothesis, right? And that refers to this notion that there is a chemical imbalance, primarily serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, underlying the pathologies that we are labeling as psychiatric. And frankly, it's a very broad swath, right? So it ranges from, you know, eating disorders to multiple different anxiety syndromes, from OCD to phobias to generalized anxiety, and of course includes depression. And these are all diagnoses that are treated with quote-unquote antidepressants, SSRIs and SNRIs. And so through deductive reasoning, you know, the field has essentially made the assumption that if these medications are having an effect, it must be because of what we know about their quote-unquote primary mechanism, which is that these medications interfere with the trafficking of these specific neurotransmitters, right? So, you know, people in the conventional realm leading up to NIMH are coming out and making claims, essentially supporting the fact that this science has never been validated, and we need to go back to the drawing board because of limited outcomes and potentially misconception at the root of the practice of psychiatry today. So there is an effort on the part of, you know, those even with conflicts of interest, you know, in and out of the pharmaceutical industry, there is an effort to sort of turn the page. And what many are speaking about is something called the cytokine model, which has been around since 1991. You know, the first paper hypothesizing about this model, so it's been a growing literature for some time. And what it refers to is essentially it looks at, you know, depression or anxiety, for example, as this nonspecific sort of fever, right, that tells us actually very little about what's causing the body to react, but tells us that there is an expression of imbalance and that the body is working to recalibrate, right? So there's some sort of stressor or trigger or assault, and the compensatory response on the part of the body is what we are seeing as these psychiatric symptoms. And it's actually more broadly applied. There's literature in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, but there certainly is the most in depression and a growing literature in anxiety specifically. So when we think about this model, we have a couple of different tenets that underlie it. One is that I talk about the brilliant people who are doing this research, not me, but, you know, we have these biomarkers, right? So psychiatrists have been desperate for some sort of biological legitimization of what they're doing since the inception of the field. And, you know, we may sort of have what we asked for at this point. At least it's seeming to take shape. And when I talk about biomarkers, what I mean is that there are these inflammatory messengers that circulate, and they have names like C-reactive protein, interleukin-1, interleukin-6, TNF-alpha. And in the literature, essentially, you know, there has been validated relationships between symptoms and these blood measures, okay, so that they can be, especially in women, predictive, so that you might have elevations in some of these measures like CRP before the onset of your symptoms. They can be linearly correlated so that the higher these serum levels are, the more symptomatic you are, and when they are resolved, your symptoms also resolve. And that they seem to be particularly relevant for some subsets of depression and anxiety, specifically an interest of mine, which is postpartum, but also what is called atypical depression. And that is a bit different than what we refer to as melancholic depression, which is sort of what it sounds like, because atypical depression is characterized by oversleeping, overeating, you know, sort of like cravings. Also, you know, there's a difference in feeling a bit better in the afternoons relative to the mornings. So we sort of start to draw in the relevance of the cortisol rhythm over the course of the day as a modulator of these inflammatory messengers. And it just helps us to start to think a bit about how some subsets, at least, of what we are calling depression, anxiety, and bipolar disorder specifically may actually be inflammatory response. And in this way, you know, these diagnoses are just joining the ranks of the rest of chronic disease, right? So autoimmune disorders, cancer, diabetes, different metabolic syndromes, cardiovascular disease, all of the, you know, cutting-edge research in these different pathologies is suggesting that inflammation is the underlying driver. And, you know, so some of the researchers like Mays and Raison, who have over the years tried to flesh out this theory based on the science, suggest that at some point in our evolution, this inflammatory response was adaptive, right? Because it helped us to slow down, withdraw, avoid others, you know, decrease our activity for recovery. But what we have turned, you know, we've essentially turned an acute response that was adaptive at some point in our evolutionary history into a chronic response that now the, you know, sort of the brain has to contend with and decide, you know, am I going to continue to allow this inflammatory response to exist? Am I going to try and suppress it with cortisol? Am I going to turn cortisol off at some point? So we see this sort of more chronic picture of unremitting symptoms that have a connection to many other physical states, right? So I haven't seen a patient probably ever who doesn't have a single physical complaint, whether it's headache or body aches or joint aches or gastrointestinal changes like constipation. You know, they always sort of come with this syndromal picture of bodily response. So the biomarkers are one. We also have animal models. I always find the idea of like an animal model of depression or anxiety sort of like a funny concept, but this is really what is going on, you know, in terms of bench research, and they use things like what are called forced swim tests. So essentially the animals like stop trying at a certain point. And that's considered one of the models of depression. And one of the ways that they induce it is by injection of an endotoxin called lipopolysaccharide. And this is essentially a way to inflame the animal. And what's interesting is that this, you know, when we start to think about, okay, so where does this inflammation come from, and maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit. You know, lipopolysaccharide is made by a component of gram-negative bacteria in our gut, which is supposed to be retained in our gut, not, you know, floating around in our bloodstream. So it's a bit of a, you know, a look through the keyhole as to where this inflammatory response may originate. But what's interesting is that they, in some of these rodents, they knock out a gene for a specific cytokine called interleukin-1, and the mice are actually protected against lipopolysaccharide-mediated symptoms. So we know that there is a relationship between these the inflammatory insult, but then the messengers, like, you know, these cytokines in the expressions of what we are seeing, quote-unquote, clinically. And then sort of the third tenet is that we have some pharmacologic data that supports this model, right? So we know that in hepatitis C, 45% of patients develop depression with interferon treatment, which is essentially an inflammatory treatment, which is far more than we can consider a routine side effect, right? So it's suggestive of something important in terms of the mechanism of that medication and also the, you know, the development of psychiatric symptoms. And then a number of trials have taken a look at anti-inflammatory agents like celecoxib or, you know, infliximab, you know, these sort of anti-inflammatory medications, and they have found that when patients have these inflammatory markers present and they are treatment resistant, meaning they haven't been helped by the conventional paradigm, you can resolve their symptoms with these inflammatory markers, with these anti-inflammatory medications. And there's even some suggestion, which is, you know, somewhat controversial, that antidepressants themselves, when they do have an effect, may have an anti-inflammatory effect. So forget about the whole serotonin business for a minute and think about the fact that maybe when they are having an effect, it may be because they downregulate something called interleukin-6. Most of the studies are observational, but it is somewhat provocative. So that's sort of the bedrock for the conceptualization of these pathologies as primarily inflammatory in nature and as representative of what we're calling an evolutionary mismatch, right? So our systems are not quite built or at least yet evolved to live and function optimally in the current environment. And I find that, you know, a very compelling explanation for what we are seeing as an epidemic rise in mental illness in this country and in the world.
Excellent. So I've got a few follow-on questions, if I may. One is, I found it interesting that you talk about the anti-inflammatory medications, and I know we're going to talk more about some natural ways that we can do that, but just seeing that mechanism I think is very interesting. But a follow-on question was the biomarkers. So you mentioned CRP, C-reactive protein, interleukin 1 and 6, and TNF-alpha. Are the latter, the interleukin 1 and 6 and the TNF-alpha, readily available for testing, and are we seeing correlations between those as being predictive and then also higher levels causing worse symptoms as well as the CRP?
That's a great question. So in clinical practice, so there's sort of, we talk about in functional medicine the 17-year lag between what appears in the literature and what gets to your doctor's office, right? And to some extent, with the measurement of cytokines, this has been somewhat difficult to translate because I don't think, as far as I know, sort of normative ranges and assessment sort of in the outpatient setting through LabCorp or Quest or these type BioReference, these types of labs, isn't something that most clinicians are ready to do. And what they are noticing in the literature is that these cytokines like interleukin 1 and 6 and TNF-alpha, they're looking at like qualitative changes over time. But I don't think it's reasonable to expect that, and this is true for almost every lab value, that we have a well-quantified reference range for what is optimal, right? Because what is optimal is probably a very dynamic variable. It could be optimal for a certain condition under one, you know, set of circumstances and not so much under another. What has been better quantified, and it's a slightly different, very non-specific, but pretty well-validated indicator is high-sensitivity CRP, so C-reactive protein. In psychiatry, we have a good body of literature that helps us to understand what might be a reasonable cutoff, which is 3. but, you know, it's highly nonspecific. So I will see, and you could have one CRP on a Monday that you don't have the following Friday. So it's an acute phase reactant. It's something that is the body, part of the body's response mechanism, meaning that we don't want to, you know, overly rely on it. It should inform the treatment generally. So, you know, I will check things like C-reactive protein and homocysteine to get a general picture. I'll take a look at white blood cell patterns to get a general picture of responsivity. But I also know that, you know, I can have a patient come to me with a C-reactive protein, you know, in the high 90s, and within 2 months, it could be below 1 based on pretty simple interventions. So in many ways, it's just for trending that I find it relevant because I make very similar considerations around inflammatory response for almost all of my patients. So I'm not using it the way researchers are using it to identify a subset of patients who are treatment resistant who may be, you know, eligible for another type of pharmacologic intervention because that's really how it's being used in the literature.
Okay, great. And you mentioned the reasonable cutoff of 3, but we really want it to be below 1. That's ideal.
Yes, that's ideal. And it's doable.
Yes, I've seen it. People get on a gluten-free diet and their CRP come way down. So
exactly, in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some of those interventions in a second. So it's really exciting that there is this biomarker, because we keep hearing that there are no tests for mental health disorders, and now we've got this marker that we could use. So very exciting.
Yes.
And then going back to the LPS, lipopolysaccharide, that's an endotoxin that they introduced to these animals, but this is something that us as humans can be exposed to as well, which could be a contributing factor for some of the inflammation that we might see.
Right. Exactly. And we often are in the setting of what has been dubbed intestinal permeability, right, which has been, you know, sort of, I think the concept has been largely legitimized by Alessio Fasano, who is, you know, one of the primary researchers elucidating the role of gluten and specifically its activation of something called zonulin in the promotion of intestinal permeability. But we also, you know, have other chief suspects, right? Like one of the ones I'm very interested in is glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, also BT toxin. So in genetically modified foods, we have mechanistic reason to believe that they contribute to and synergize with things like gluten in the promotion of intestinal permeability. Another one that I warn a lot of my patients about, and that's actually well documented, is intestinal permeability that can arise from NSAID exposure. So, you know, you think you're just popping an Advil or a Motrin for your menstrual cramps, and in fact, you may be, one of the unintended consequences may be that you're promoting your own intestinal permeability so that the luminal contents, so that whatever's going on in your gut now has access to your bloodstream and to your immune and inflammatory cascades in ways that it might not have otherwise.
Excellent. Do we want to continue with other factors that can cause this inflammation? You've mentioned the NSAIDs and the gluten and the GMO foods. Do we want to talk about sugar and antibiotics right now, and then we'll go on to psychoneuroendocrinology with the connection to the hormones?
Let's do it. Yes. Yeah, so I think that sugar is, it's really funny. I was on the train last night and I saw an ad for a new Coca-Cola, right? And it's got a green label and it's called Coca-Cola Life. And it's sweetened with cane sugar and stevia. I thought, you can't make this stuff up. You know, so obviously there is some awareness of the potential problems of sugar, and we tried to get around it with all of the synthetic, you know, with aspartame and all of the sort of like Me Too chemical agents that now, of course, are raising signals of harm that are too loud to ignore, just trying to replicate that sweet taste. So I think that there's a growing awareness that there may be more to sugar than just cavities, right? And in my practice, it's one of the chief concerns I have. You know, I treat women of reproductive age, most of whom suffer from anxiety, if not all of whom. And, you know, I had a patient in here last week who came in, and she was on two medications. She had just gotten out of the hospital. She had been on a laundry list of medications over the past 12 years, and she was having still, out of the hospital, what she said was 6 panic attacks a day. Okay, I didn't start her on a single supplement. She was already actually trying to exercise. I didn't have to bark up that tree. So really all that she did in the intervening window between, you know, her first consultation and the follow-up appointment a month later was, you know, we'll talk about it, but it was dietary modification. She came in at her follow-up and she said, for the first time in my adult life, I have not had a panic attack in 30 days. I had her blood work back at that point, and she had a hemoglobin A1C of 5.9, a fasting blood sugar of 101. This is like a healthy, young, attractive woman, right? This is not like your picture of a diabetic. And so I knew all that we had done in that month, it is not magic. All that we did was stabilize her blood sugar, and her quote-unquote psychiatric symptoms disappeared. So for me, you know, this is one of many, 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 many instances in my practice of where the stabilization of blood sugar is the primary intervention, you know, toward resolution of what we are calling anxiety specifically, but also like sort of the dark underbelly of anxiety, which is like brain fog, lethargy, sort of like this general sense of malaise, insomnia, and it's all part of that, you know, sort of roller coaster of dysglycemia, of blood sugar instability. So in addition to being essentially an endocrine disruptor, right, so tugging on your insulin and therefore your cortisol, pulling from your progesterone, interfering with thyroid function, it also is, frankly, inflammatory, right? So, you know, I remember, you know, one of the first times I saw a paper like this must have been a decade or so ago of the acute immunosuppressive effects of sugar. And we know that it's, you know, an agent that can influence these cascades that we just spent some time talking about. So it's sort of, you know, a twofer, or maybe a threefer, or multiply, you know, sort of donating to the healing process to eliminate it. But, of course, my angle on that is and most people who are interested in dysglycemia, is to also simultaneously make more natural fats available for beta oxidation, for burning. So I'm very interested in that as a source of inflammation. I'm also interested in, you know, in the role of stress response, and some people actually start with this, and certainly there are many therapists and healers who really work on the level of the stress response alone and get the same outcomes that I do, you know, with somewhat more complex or at least demanding interventions. But we know that you know, sort of the acute stress response recruits cortisol, which is a natural immunosuppressive, in the initial response. But then over time, you know, your brain, which is essentially responsible for recruiting cortisol, says, you know, this is not adaptive for physiology, and starts to diminish the signal. So, you know, what some people talk about as adrenal fatigue and adrenal burnout, really focusing on the gland, you know, I and some others are interested in looking more at the role of the brain as the master commander of that. So where the gland is actually somewhat secondary to the decisions, essentially, that the brain is making about this chronic stress picture. And that's really where the role of cultivation of mindfulness, of what I've sort of referred to as personal non-resistance, you know, this sort of idea of engaging the stress in your life very differently, and sort of leaning away from it rather than getting tossed up in the fray, is a very powerful tool. And in fact, you know, research out of the Herbert Benson Institute over like four decades has demonstrated that you can have changes in inflammatory and insulin signaling gene responses over 20 minutes of total, you know, novice level meditation, quote unquote, which is really subjects listening to a guided visualization in their, you know, earbuds. So this is not master meditators, although over time, you know, the more you do it, the more benefit, more robust benefits you get. And so there's been a really interesting body of literature that supports the anti-inflammatory effects of control of relaxation response. So I think that those are big ones, and then sort of the primary tie-in to maybe, you know, what we'll talk about in a bit is, so what is the role of dysbiosis? So what is the role of suboptimal gut microbiota ecosystems in the inflammatory response? And the other two categories I just mentioned directly impact, you know, sort of the health of your microbiome, but certainly so do infections and medications. And there's, you know, even things like birth control. So there's a long list of considerations that we need to start making if we are going to finally acknowledge that the seat of our health is not even just in our gut, but it's specifically in our microbiome. And so that's really been one of the most exciting points of entry for me, and where I've really come to focus a lot of my attention, I guess.
Great. And we're going to get onto that one in a second. I just wanted to go back to two things that you'd said. I just think it's wonderful that you can see such amazing results by stabilizing blood sugar. Isn't that so powerful?
I'm not sure I would believe it if I didn't see it with my own eyes, frankly, given my training and where I'm coming from. It's seeing it replicated over and over, and also seeing it personally. You know, I was absolutely, you know, that girl who ate Snickers and Twizzlers every day and drank 6 cups of coffee, you know, and ran around on carbs and dairy, you know, all through my training. So, and I was hungry all the time. I was exhausted all the time. And I had practically like an arrhythmia, you know, 60% of the time, my heart racing through my chest. So, you know, I know from personal experience that this is something modifiable, that it's not just the way you are, it's not your personality, and it's certainly not your psychiatric diagnosis that you can take to the grave.
Right, exactly. And then I'd love you to just give clarification for those who may not know HbA1c, what do we want it to be, and just explain what it is for folks who may not know.
Right. So it's a measure of a red blood cell measure of glycated hemoglobin. And essentially what it demonstrates is, you know, what I describe for patients is that it's sort of the degree of damage that sugar, but also other sorts of advanced glycation end products, you know, so even like charring your meat and that sort of thing, and your, you know, baking overbaking like sweet things like breads and stuff like that in the oven even. So the other sources, but it's primarily from the total, you know, quantification of sugar load in your diet and how much it is disrupting cellular function. So there's actually some debate as to whether or not it's a very reliable source, you know, because the turnover of red blood cells can be different from patient to patient, and so you can get sort of like false elevations. But, you know, when you triangulate it with fasting insulin, fasting glucose, and even something called fructosamine, you can start to get a picture of how relevant this is for patients. I like to see it definitely below 5.2, but meaning ideally, you know, in the high fours range, but absolutely not above 5.6. I mean, above 5.6, you know, David Perlmutter has collated literature suggesting that above 5.6, you know, you're at statistically significant increased risk of Alzheimer's. So we certainly know that there is that there are deleterious effects at the brain level at that point, and that's what's given rise to this notion of diabetes type 3 or sort of diabetes of the brain. So I like to see it, and this is something that over about 2 months you'll see a change. So if you want to track more immediate changes, like over the past 2 to 3 weeks, let's say, then you'll probably want to use fasting insulin, glucose, and fructosamine as an alternative. So with hemoglobin A1C, you'd see a change, you know, within about 2 months. I think one of my favorite studies was about, like, Aboriginal Australians who had sort of integrated into the mainstream, and they all had type 2 diabetes, and they were taken out of civilization, essentially, put back in the bush, and they were hunting and gathering, and within 6 weeks, all of them reversed their type 2 diabetes. Been 6 weeks.
Wow.
So it's pretty compelling, right? I love naturalistic data like that. I think it's so much more exciting than a randomized placebo-controlled trial. But I think that's, you know, just a powerful indicator of how fluctuant this can be. I think it's something that I take pretty seriously.
Wonderful. And then the HbA1c is reflective of the previous 3 months, correct?
About two to three months.
Okay. Great. And then glucose, you mentioned that hers was 101. We want it under 100.
Yeah, I even like to have it under 90 because of some data suggesting that anything over, even points over 89 start to correlate with insulin resistance. And, you know, Kate Shanahan is a family physician I really admire, and she wrote a great book called Deep Nutrition that was very impactful for me, and, you know, she's sort of collected a lot of the data that suggests that over 90 is concerning. The reference range on your lab slip, yeah, is going to be 100, sometimes even 110, but your insulin signaling mechanism is already largely compromised at that point when you have fasting sugars in that range, you know, upon waking.
Okay, great. And who was that book that you, can you just repeat?
Kate Shanahan.
Okay.
Yeah, great. She's great.
Excellent. And then insulin, what do you like to see for insulin?
Below 6. Okay. I like to see it below 6, but this is a complex, for my patient population, it's a complex issue because you also don't want it too low. because of the role, it has many roles, of course, but the role of insulin in conversion of storage form of thyroid to active form. And, you know, certainly its role in amino acid passage into the brain. So it's also, it's a needle you want to thread, like anything. You want some inflammatory signaling. You want some cortisol. You want some insulin, but you want to sort of hit that Goldilocks spot. And so I like to see it between like 2 and 6.
Okay, great. And then any cutoff for fructosamine?
That I normally use mostly for trending, but, you know, below 200 would be nice, and often I'm just looking at, like, decrement, so I'll see a patient come in 350 or something, and then they'll come back the next time, and if they have a 280, I'm pretty excited. So it's not a hard line. I'm not sure if other people use hard lines on that.
Okay, great. And then going back to your comment about the new Coca-Cola, the whole issue with the cane sugar is we've got this Roundup that's sprayed on the sugar
exactly.
before harvest, so we're getting that exposure as well.
Exactly. And it's, you know, I mean, it's you just look at the bottle and you think you're getting your serving of vegetables for the day or something like trying to suggest that it's some sort of a health food, but it's really, in many ways, I sort of love it because it's bowing down to this demand that is bubbling up to the surface on the part of consumers for some acknowledgement of what these corporations have done to our health over the years. So, you know, they're not trying to make us well or healthy. They're trying to get you to buy their product, but at least there's an acknowledgement that this is of interest to people, you know, which I think is in many ways kind of nice. It's kind of validating.
Yes. And then I do want to just comment on your mindfulness recommendation because that is so powerful. You know, you just mentioned controlling blood sugar, eating real food, and mindfulness. And how powerful is that? I just think it's so wonderful. And then I'm glad you mentioned novice because some people think that's a big deal. And if someone can just listen to a guided imagery tape and get some amazing results like that, how wonderful is that for a starting point if someone is feeling overwhelmed by the thought of getting into meditation or something like that?
Absolutely. And I can relate to that. You know, I'm not like and wasn't ever sort of like a new agey hippie person. I've certainly become one. But I wasn't ever that like that. And so then if I put myself in the position of a lot of these patients and I have somebody tell me to meditate, I would just say, that's not for me. I don't do that. I don't have time for that. And I, you know, what do I need, like a picture of Buddha and a cushion? That's ridiculous, right? So if that is unappealing, then forget all that. And what you can engage is really simple. And I give my patients, you know, sort of a long list of choices from books with, you know, that come with CDs to apps on their phone, mm-hmm. to online, you know, websites with you know, streaming MP3s, or even to, you know, HeartMath, right, and the M-Wave, which is like a little biofeedback gadget for those who like, I find it very cool, those who like to sort of see in real time quantification of their progress, which essentially it just uses these lights to tell you how to breathe and measures your heart rate variability so that you can see that your breathing is actually improving your electronic resonance. Pretty cool. So there are many different ways to engage it, and the most passive is just, you know, plugging in some earphones and listening to, you know, a 5-minute, but ideally 20-minute guided visualization. And it seems, according to the data, that just even walking the walk without even really engaging it with any level of expertise has beneficial effects. So there's really no reason not to get started. And I ask patients to just start with 5 minutes because I feel like, you know, most of my patients are moms and they're professionals, and I feel like 5 minutes is about all we mentally feel we can potentially spare. So let's just start with that, and then work up to the 20, and that's all that's required. It's so simple, really.
It is. And I'm glad you mentioned giving people a choice, because for some it just feels like, oh, I can't do that. But I'll do the same. I'll say, well, there's this HeartMath, a tool that you can do on your computer. If you're on your computer anyway during the day, maybe that's something you could do. Pick 5 minutes out of your day to do
exactly.
that. And there's actually a wonderful HeartMath program, I'm sure you're familiar with it, where you can actually see this picture painting in the colors as you are slowing down your breathing. And I've had a lot of my clients really enjoy that. So I think it's a matter of finding what's going to work for you and then actually making the time. And 5 minutes is a great start.
Yeah, better than nothing.
Yes, definitely. Okay, so now we need to get on to the microbiome. And I actually had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Ted Dynan for the summit. And as you know, he's the Irish researcher who's coined this term psychobiotics together with his colleagues.
Yeah.
And I know you talk about from the gut to the brain and back again. So let's talk about the gut and what a healthy microbiome looks like.
Yes, it's funny. I wrote a little blog article about his paper, and I just found it so exciting. And when he read it, just happened to read it and contacted me, I felt like this. I had just gotten like an email from George Clooney or something. Like, I was so excited.
He's a wonderful man. Isn't that
really
amazing?
I mean,
what he's doing.
It's just very exciting, you know, that there is beginning to be some acknowledgement in the peer-reviewed literature for our co-evolution with the microbial world. And, you know, for the role of things, traditional foods like fermented vegetables, for example, like why might have cultures done that for so many centuries? You know, what is that about? Was there some ancient wisdom there? And have those practices influenced, you know, sort of what our microbes are expecting to see? You know, so this is a very, very big topic, and it's exciting that it's so big, because it is an explosion of literature, really. Mm-hmm. But the reason I'm so interested in it is for the reason that I mentioned, right? So we want to ask, what is driving inflammation? How does it sort of get kicked off? And, you know, to my mind, since the completion of the Human Genome Project in 2002, we've had to figure out, you know, where is it that all of our physiologic processes are happening? Because it's certainly not at the one gene equals one protein level, right? So that gave birth to the sort of science of epigenetics. But in sort of part of this epigenetic puzzle is how much of our epigenetic signaling is carried out at the gut microbe level. So, you know, the responsibilities of our gut bacteria, and I'm sure this was discussed, it's a list that is growing every day. So ranging from production, you know, bacteria produce amino acids. They aid in digestion of things, including gluten, that we are largely incapable of digesting. They produce fatty acids, like specific saturated fats that have anti-inflammatory effects like butyrate, even at the brain level. You know, they, in many ways, dictate our immune response because of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. 70% of our immune system is housed in our gut. It is our greatest interface with the environment. So when you look at it through that lens, you can really start to see how it is that food can have such an impact, right? And what's important to, you know, acknowledge is that the literature has elucidated that there is this bidirectional relationship between the gut and the brain, so that what goes on in the gut actually can, primarily through the vagus nerve, but there are also other mechanisms at the blood-brain barrier, translate inflammatory signaling in the gut to the brain. And the brain takes over at that point, and the microglia, so these immune systems in the brain, which frankly we didn't even really know had a role even 10 years ago, start to change the way that, for example, you know, tryptophan is broken down, starts to make different kinds of compounds that put you into a vigilant state, you know, a self-protective state. So it's very compelling. And the question that I have been very interested in, because of the population I treat, which is mostly women who are preparing for pregnancy, pregnant or postpartum, and I feel passionately about impacting the next generation, is, you know, so how do we build a healthy microbiome? Like, where does it start? And it appears to really start in utero, you know, where we used to think, one of the many, many, many misconceptions we've made in medicine and science is we used to think that the womb was a sterile place. And now we are learning that, you know, there is transfer from the mom's gut through, we think, dendritic cells into the fetus, you know, into the baby in utero. So that is followed up by, and the placenta itself even has a now relatively quantified microbiome. So all of these different, you know, areas of the body carry their own signature strains. It's very interesting. So that is followed up by the relevance of a vaginal birth and even a vaginal home birth specifically because of research, you know, out of, since 2011 that has suggested that babies born vaginally in the hospital versus born at home vaginally have an elevated risk of colonization with C. difficile, Clostridium difficile. You know, so and that is followed up by a very tailored conversation between mom and baby around immune factors and gut bacteria in what's called enteromammary circulation. So it's gut to breast circulation and distribution of microbes. And also, interestingly, of 200-plus what are called oligosaccharides, so these special types of sugars that don't break down but are specifically designed almost to feed bacteria like bifidobacteria in the infant gut. So it's this, I don't know, beautiful orchestration of events that seed our infant gut, and that's pretty much what we carry with us, you know, and what determines our stress signaling pattern into adulthood. And, you know, then you use vaccines, you take antibiotics, you take steroids, you take birth control, you eat sugar and processed fats, you know, you live a chronically stressful life, you're exposed to metals, and, you know, then you end up in my office, right? but the most, you know, amazing thing, you know, we've already touched on, is that you would think you'd be sort of pretty screwed at that point, right? Like it's been 3 decades of essentially assaulting what took, you know, about 2 years to create, you know, with this mother-baby dyad. And the truth is you can still rectify it, you know, you can still fix it and heal it, and it can be done in as little as like 2 to 6 months. I find that really powerful, you know, because I have children, I don't treat them, but I would imagine that would be an important window to intervene, you know, and that it would be tough for me to treat the patients that I do, you know, who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, but it's amazingly still plastic. And I think that the greatest way to move the needle, and we have data that within 72 hours of dietary change, your microbiome shifts. And, you know, we don't really know, unfortunately, yet, and it may even be too late to quantify what an optimal, healthy microbiome looks like. And that's, you know, a bummer because it would have been nice at some point in history if our awareness of the microbiome coincided with our ability, you know, through the type of technology that we have now to identify proteomic analysis of bacterial genes, you know, it would have been nice to be able to quantify it then. But, of course, now we have subjects. I mean, if I were to do what is being touted in the lay press as the next miracle cure for inflammatory bowel disease is a fecal transplant, right? If I were to do a fecal transplant, which is essentially taking a donation of stool into my gut, I don't even know who I would use as a donor. I don't know a person alive who I think has what I would consider a healthy microbiome. And unfortunately, it's because of the transgenerational passage, right? So I am my mom's microbiome, who is her mom's microbiome, and my children, you know, sort of inherit that. So, you know, we're in a bit of a pickle there, but we do have some interesting data that has looked at hunter-gatherer tribes, specifically the Hadza in Tanzania, and has tried to quantify differences between their microbiome and urban-dwelling Italians. And what's interesting is that they found that there were significant differences, including the fact that the Hazda had no bifidobacter, right? So in the holistic and functional medicine community, we think bifidobacter is like one of the most important beneficial strains. So they had no bifidobacter. They also had, you know, some strains that we think of as being pathogenic. And there were significant differences between the women and the men. And there was a theory posited in the paper that that's because the women eat more tubers and honey than the men. And I think that's really compelling because it's certainly what I see in my practice is that there is a role for non-grain carbohydrates, specifically starchy vegetables and tubers, for women that may not be as relevant for men. So, listen, we're doing the best we can with the information we have, and more of it is coming down the pike, and hopefully it won't be, you know, before as a population, we have diminished what is called the core microbiome. So what should be the most optimal expression of our microbiome before we can quantify it. So onward.
Fascinating, really fascinating. And there's also some there's a lot of research in this area looking at traditional diets and how that can affect the microbiome. And I think I saw a study looking at rural Africans. And found that those eating, or is this the rural Africans? Is this the Hazda that you're talking about eating this?
No, because there's been exactly. You're mentioning another one, which is looking more at sort of like neo agricultural Africans. Yes.
Yeah.
And they also had differences from the hunter gatherers, differences from us. So differences in diversity, differences in dominant phyla. So it's compelling. I think that's the most interesting because it's not just about what they're eating, but it's their soil, right? It's the cultural habits around how they eat. Hopefully it's not the way I eat half the time, which is like a 9-minute lunch break between patients. So they're relaxing when they're eating in a different way. It's a different ceremony. So yeah, it's compelling. And also, you know, traditional, there's been papers looking at the role of lipopolysaccharide. So what we mentioned earlier, being diminished by a traditional diet relative to a Western diet. So that's, you know, what more information do you need to convince you that, that cleaning up your diet might be the first step to your mental health? I don't know.
Wonderful. And then you mentioned the Aboriginals. I bet if they'd looked at their microbiome before and after, they would have seen a big difference once they went back into the bush.
I bet, absolutely no question, because there's a lot of compelling suggestion that insulin signaling and many metabolic parameters originate in the gut, and that's potentially why things like berberine have, you know, antimicrobial herbs have an impact on insulin signaling, and even comparable to something like metformin. And it's really because of changes and improvements at the gut level. It's really compelling. It's where it's at. The gut is absolutely where it's at.
Really interesting. And I did not know that the placenta had a microbiome. So that's very interesting. And I know this is your area looking at, you know, women pre-pregnancy and post-pregnancy. And it's fascinating
weird about it is that it seems to be primarily dominated by maternal oral flora. So, I don't know. That argues the potential importance of getting, you know, your oral hygiene in check before pregnancy. But, yeah, it's compelling.
It is. And then you just mentioned, you know, all these exposures of things that we get, and you mentioned metals. And I just saw a study that came out this month looking at yogurt-containing bacteria as being successfully protecting children and pregnant women against the effects of heavy metal exposure. They're thinking that might be a factor. So that's
compelling. Yes, that study was funded by the Gates Foundation, so I have my suspicions about their agenda. But yes, it is compelling. I mean, there's almost nothing that these bacteria can't do. You know, it's really incredible. You know, detoxification of perchlorate, for example, they really seem to carry most of the weight in terms of our physiologic processes. So it's best we learn to cooperate with them and stop thinking about germs and microbes as being the enemy that we have to sort of like blast out of existence when they get unruly. We have to work with them in a totally different mindset.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And so let's talk a little bit about anything else about diet and some of your favorite nutraceuticals.
Yes. So the sort of, I guess, brief overview is that I use in my practice Whole30. I license their material, the Hartwig material, and it's really just common sense eating. You know, it's in this really pretty package in terms of the PDF, but it's really just common sense eating. So it's a very primary focus put on the sourcing. So I ask my patients to do a month of 100% organic, which essentially means, you know, using a specific delivery service or cooking all their food at home for 1 month. And I ask that they limit their diet to pastured meat, eggs, fish, nuts and seeds, and then fruit and vegetables. And that is it. So we're not eating dairy, we're not eating legumes, soy, peanuts, and we're not eating, of course, vegetable oils and sugar. I actually don't control for fruit very much. It's not a big part of what I cut down on unless I'm going for a specifically ketogenic diet, very, very low-carb diet if I have a patient with epilepsy or, you know, acute mania or something along those lines, or very, you know, very resistant blood sugar problems, then we might do something more ketogenic and control for starchy vegetables and fruit. But usually in the first month, I take out white potatoes, but I leave in sweet, and that's because white potatoes are a type of resistant starch that can either be a great thing as a prebiotic that feeds bacteria, but until your bacteria are sort of more aligned optimally, you sort of want to limit these prebiotics and those types of starchy foods for bacteria. And that's it. And I ask patients to be very aggressive about fat intake, so things like coconut oil and ghee and egg yolks multiple a day, animal foods, and, you know, avocados, nuts and seeds, of course, but really more the former. And that's how we try to control for the blood sugar picture. And then later, you know, in months two, three sort of a thing, I incorporate more and more starches. So I'm a moderate carb, you know, kind of gal. And even according to Paul Jaminet, you know, the Perfect Health Diet, is potentially even using white rice, cooled white rice, as a resistant starch. And there are going to be some people for whom white rice is or rice itself is a cross-reactant to gluten sensitivity, but many for whom it's not. And so it's that type of personalization that comes later. And it's really powerful. I mean, you know, I was a vegetarian for a while. I certainly am not in the business of converting ethical vegetarians and vegans into meat eaters. But for those who are interested in promoting health and a diet that does that, I think that this is a pretty good template, you know, and it's you know, the outcomes in terms of what would otherwise be chronic and irreversible conditions, you know, across many different practitioners in this country, including yourself, is, you know, we all could tell stories of what a version of this approach can do. So it's only after that I start to think about supplementation, and usually it's by the time I have at least blood work, if not salivary results or stool results back or fatty acid testing. And I sort of think about the replacement in terms of, like, building blocks, so minerals like zinc and magnesium, and then other micronutrients, iodine, selenium, inositol. I think about amino acids like theanine and acetylcysteine. I'm very big into fatty acids, not as much fish oil. If I use fish oil, it would be for a very short-term high-dose trial, like 2 months. Of 3 to 6 grams of a high EPA fish oil, but I don't think of it as a wellness supplement for everyone, because I'm also interested in how we can skew our body's own mechanisms by taking these super therapeutic nutrients forever. So, you know, meaning that you can suppress your omega-6. I also use a lot of evening primrose oil for that reason. Cod liver oil, things like butyrate. Of course, curcumin is probably my most favorite of all supplements. I'm very compelled by the data that's coming out in the psychiatric realm, including placebo-controlled trials, comparator trials to medications, looking at the effects of curcumin. It just, you know, we keep learning about more and more and more. But, of course, the effects of turmeric itself, so like the actual food, are probably even more robust. In fact, I know them to be. So you know, again, when we use supplements this way, we're taking a sometimes a bit of a pharmaceutical mind to it, you know, isolating the ingredient and dosing it specifically. But I do think that curcumin is another acute intervention I use. And then, of course, there's gut support, so probiotics and enzymes, betaine, you know, hydrochloric acid, botanicals like rhodiola and ashwagandha, often used to help with cortisol response. And then sometimes hormone balancing. So I use a lot of maca, chaste tree in my practice, you know, and vitamin C for that purpose, sometimes licorice root. So it's a very long list, and that's why I think, you know, you can totally overwhelm patients if you're like, here's your 85 supplements to meet every single evidence-based problem I suspect you might be having. But I think it just makes a lot more sense to clear the slate. So like exercise, meditation, diet for a month, then we can actually see what's going on. And then we can use these agents strategically and hopefully in a relatively short-term manner, like, you know, 2 to 9 months maybe, to sort of take it home. So that's the overview.
Wonderful. This has been fantastic. And I just love that you say get to the basics, clean the slate, and then add in where you need to. So this is wonderful. And to see the amazing results that you see is just fabulous. And we appreciate psychiatrists like you. It's really great. And it's been so wonderful having you on the summit again. Thank you for all this great information. We do have a gift from you, and it's kellybroganmd.com, and we'll make sure that link is on the page and on the blog for this, Top 7 Therapeutic Foods. And any final words of wisdom?
No, except for that I just realized I didn't say anything about B vitamins, which is very upsetting.
Oh.
It's probably like my most powerful intervention. So just a shout out for B12 before we close. This
Right.
is such a, I could talk about this all day, Trudy. So this is such an exciting topic, and I really appreciate your including me and getting the word out about this to a broader community, because you know, it's those of us in the trenches who really see the power of this model of health and are most passionate about it. So we all need to spread the word together. I think it's wonderful.
Great. Well, thanks again, Kelly. It's been fantastic. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on another great interview on the Anxiety Summit. This is Trudy Scott signing off.